Welcome to the Research Studio, the place where we talk to current doctoral students involved in practice-based, practice-led, or practice-informed research in the arts. My name is Dr. Mark Wilshire, and I'm based at Norwich University of the Arts in the UK. I'm an artist and academic involved in doctoral supervision, and I want to use my experience of making artworks and exhibitions to think about the different roles that creative practice can play within academic research. My guest today is Christian Peterson. Christian is a graphic novelist, a lecturer, and artistic researcher whose work explores the role of narrative and visual communication in addressing environmental and societal challenges. Currently undertaking a part-time PhD at Norwich University of the Arts, Christian employs ethnographic and critical design approaches in his research, which focuses on developing methods for working outside conventional design studio contexts. His thesis is currently titled Leaving the Studio: Prototyping Post-Studio Design Practices. Welcome, Christian.
Thank you so much, Mark.
It's great to have you here in the studio. I wanted to start today by talking not about your thesis, but by talking about kind of a little bit about the process. And you're in the not totally uncommon, but reasonably unusual position of having switched institutions during your PhD. You started off at the University of Huddersfield, and now you're at Norwich University of the Arts. And I just wondered how that came about and what it's been like switching institutions.
So first and foremost, it's been like a great experience switching institutions. It's like, you know, riddled with anxieties and stuff, right? And I can speak to that a little bit more. But I also found it, as is the case with many things at universities, it was not that complicated. Mm. It just took a really long time. So the whole process, I think it started in July and it was concluded in November. Mm. So that's like a good, almost like 6 months.
How far were you into your
I was fairly far along. Mm. I had just like maybe 6 months before I'd concluded, I've sort of done my second and last progression panel, which it's different at different institutions. Some institutions do upgrades, some institutions do progression panels after each year. Mm-hmm. So I just completed my last progression panel. So I was fairly far along as well, which is also, you know, you need to, when you do make that transfer, let me go a little bit back, because you asked, how did that come about?
Yeah.
And I think, as with many, many things, like COVID had a role to play in that, right? COVID had a role to play in like reshaping my research. And maybe you can speak about that better later. But it also had a role in the institutional setup and stuff. So the long and short of it was that my supervision team at my previous institution at Huddersfield, they were they either left or they were made redundant.
I see. Okay.
When there was like cutbacks at the institution.
Yeah. Your whole team?
Whole team. For various different reasons. I was previously employed with Huddersfield, so I was undertaking my PhD as part of my, like, you know, all the other activities, research activities and teaching activities. I moved to a new job here. I wanted to stick with my supervision team at Huddersfield. It means I became like a self-financed student instead of like having the privilege of getting my studentship paid for and that sort of thing. But I think any PhD student any researchers know how important the supervision team is. Mm. And even when I started my PhD, the first thing I was told was, it's about finding the right supervisors first. And then you start a discussion with them about what this project looks like. And then we can start enrolling, putting together proposals, applying, and all that kind of stuff. So it came out of that. I was at the institution. I'd moved work, but stayed a student at the previous institution. I no longer had a supervision team there. I decided to move it here. It's been a really positive thing just to have that closeness with my new supervision team. They've been very open. They've been like, there's been so much trust and goodwill in terms of like, you know, taking on my ideas, taking on the, you know, all that was already in place.
And you were just saying before we started recording that You've always been sort of supervised by people who are maybe more from the theoretical end of things. Have you found here, because you're at Norwich University of the Arts now, which is much more sort of a practice-based art school in effect, have you found that there's more emphasis on the practice side of things here, or is it equally theoretical?
In some sense, I think more broadly in the research culture here, there's definitely more focus on that. I think in some ways that was also the case as my previous institution. I think it's very specifically about the supervision team and like the skill set within the supervision team, where my supervisors were writers, critics, theorists. I've actually found that really, really productive, like a really positive thing, because coming from a practice background, coming from a training background, where there's historically, at least like in Scandinavia and from my previous education in the UK as well, previously in art courses, there haven't been a lot of emphasis. And that's due to a lot of different reasons, right? In terms of like how it's been structured, and maybe some places have been more focused on teaching, and like some places have like gained the university status more recently and stuff. But it was actually, so on one end, it's it means that the practice that's part of my PhD doesn't necessarily mirror what I considered my practice going into research. So I feel in some ways I could have done more work in terms of situating my practice in a research context. What happened instead was it became like a reformulation of practice and how that could look within research. And that was very much driven by research questions. And we can talk a little bit about that later. You just mentioned like how I'm a graphic novelist. Yeah. Let's just put it out there. Like, as of now, there's no visual narrative.
Yeah.
As part of the final thesis. Outcome, right?
So let's talk about the thesis now a little bit more. So the way I understand it, your title is Leaving the Studio, Prototyping Post-Studio Design Practices. And you are interested in this question of what does leaving the studio look like for the visual communication designer? I wonder, could you say a little bit about how you came to this question and how and what kind of drives it?
So there's kind of ideas that are mainly coming out of like a social science space, like out of design anthropology, about design and what role it plays in the world. Not so much from design practice itself yet, but and the main sort of proponent from these ideas is a guy called Arturo Escobar, who wrote a book called Designs for the Pluriverse. And this is the book is kind of a critical survey of both design practice and design research more generally. And in that book, he talks about like how design has sort of needs to have like a more direct involvement with the communities it serves, with the clients they serve, with the places they get their inspiration from, the problems they're solving, right? And he talks about it in the terms of leaving the studio and going into the flow of social, natural life. So, again, going back to this idea of like the sort of theory practice thing, he's a theorist, right? He's not a designer. So there's not a lot. So his solution is very much conditioned by theory. So he says, like, we as designers need to align ourselves more with social theory, be more like anthropologists, right? From my perspective as a designer, I think there is probably stuff in our sort of that we could do as designers. Let me put it this way. He doesn't offer any practical, technical solutions about what designing the leaving the studio looks like.
Right? Yeah, that doesn't sound very helpful.
No, and that's what we need as designers, right? So as a designer, I want to go into that space. I want to see how, what does leaving the studio actually look like for the designer? So we can talk that in depth about later, but there's not a lot of precedence for that I've found in design for this idea of leaving studio. There's not even like a really deep understanding of how the studio itself supports design practice. All the sort of research you see is very often about the design process, the creative process itself, or it's about like authorship, like, you know, the design scene as sort of decision making about what leaves the studio and what doesn't in terms of like ideas and prototypes and designs and that kind of thing. But it's almost like designers have forgotten the actual context which is within their practice.
Yeah.
Or haven't considered it a lot. Luckily, other fields have done it. So I'm primarily not looking at design practice. I'm looking at artists. So in the 60s and 70s, there was like a post-studio art practice.
Yeah.
That's like a moment that never made it to design.
So you're there, you're talking about things like performance art, live art, earth art.
Like the whole, like it's all Californian, right? What is it called? Balsadari. Like, you know, who sort of famously burned all his canvases and like picked up a video camera to start doing performance installation, that kind of thing. And for me, that's like a beautiful example, right?
But that never reached the design world and the design studio.
I would say so.
Yeah.
I would say so at that moment. And I think according to Escobar again, we are at a moment, we're almost like at a, there's like a crisis now in design where like design practice is not like fully engaged with like the world outside the studio. But even more than that, what Escobar says, like that design is actually contributing to what he calls like structured unsustainability. Like we are involved in something that he calls like defuturing, like that our practice of design, the manufacture of design, is putting a big, too big of a tax on like the planet's ability to sustain life, right?
So that's the crisis.
That's a crisis. And he talks about it in terms of defuturing. So that's where.
Okay.
That's like in a nutshell, what it's about. About finding these like very practical solutions to maybe some theoretical problems.
That's really interesting. So I know that part of what your thesis has been looking at sort of case studies of people from other disciplines who have gone beyond the studio. So you've looked at Joan Didion going out, becoming a foreign correspondent in El Salvador and sort of taking journalism out in the field. And the new journalism of the 1970s, is that right?
Yeah, 60s, 70s.
But just before we get into that, could you give us maybe a couple of examples of, I mean, this is the ultimate question, really, the big question of the thesis, what does visual communication practice look like outside the studio? I mean, are you literally out there in a marketplace making things? Drawing.
So maybe what I could how I could speak to that is kind of talk a little bit about how I structured the essay.
Because
you mentioned Joan Didion.
Yes.
That's a historical case study, right? So it has application. It established precedents for like a post-studio, in my case, design practice. So basically how the PhD is structured is there's two chapters which are looking at historical precedents. And then the third part of the last part of the PhD is field work that I do.
Uh-huh.
And that's mainly workshops, collaborative workshops, where I sort of try to test out some of the ideas or some of the sort of assertions that I sort of come to in the sort of more theoretical part of it. So it has this kind of element of field testing. Going back to what you said, so as of now, I myself hasn't done a lot of drawing, which is kind of like my practice in a sense, right? My creative practice. But there has been drawing involved. So there's been ideas of thinking about collaborative drawing, and that has very much involved like workshop participants going into the field and bringing together like these ideas of field work that you know from journalism, but also anthropology, a big part. I mentioned Arturo Escobar already, but I found that especially like anthropology and especially ethnographic practice, especially the thinking around ethnographic practice, has been really like important in sort of for many reasons. In many ways, a lot of anthropologists see ethnography more like a practice than a theory or like a more theoretical method in a sense, right? And you can see why that is. Going into the field, observing people, taking notes, engaging with them, interviewing, so on and so forth, right? So so it makes it a little bit like convoluted and weird in a way, because I'm looking at like a fashion photographer, that's the other case study, Paul Hyman, and I'm looking at Joan Didion, a journalist and writer and a filmmaker, producer. But I'm almost like always looking at them through the prism of like ethnography as well. Yeah. So it's a little like, it comes a little bit.
Quite a fusion.
Maybe
it'd be useful to talk a little bit about spatial ecologies. So this is your kind of an application of what you learned from the case studies and from all the theory. And this is a project that you've carried out here in Norwich, and you're planning to carry it out again.
Tell
me a little bit about it. What is spatial ecologies? What does it consist of?
So it's kind of an opportunity that was given to us by the architecture and interior design program here, which is led by Teresa Stupani. So I've been working with staff within the architecture department, and we were given like very much a carte blanche from Teresa Stupani to do like a pilot course. Elin Lund, who's also a lecturer here and elsewhere, and she's a PhD student at UCL. It's a little bit of a side note, but she's like trying to fuse architecture and movement performance. She has been like really instrumental. So it's not I, it's we.
Yeah.
It's always a we, right? She has been quite instrumental in initiating the project, first of all, and I've sort of come in, and it's become a very collaborative effort. Then we've had other people joining afterwards, such as another PhD student here, who's called Gustavo Balbela, who's also a, So this kind of setup, for me, it's a very collaborative effort, so it's really important for me to sort of, it's not me, it's
us. Is that collaborative ethos part of leaving the studio?
Yeah, very much so.
Getting out and working with all sorts
which probably is like fairly, like that's something I've learned through the research, right? That's something I've found out, and it's been really highlighted to me through the more theoretical historical research, looking at these case studies. In a way, it's like whenever you look at participatory design, whenever you look at anthropological design, like our design anthropology, they always highlight it. Like, you know, so maybe it's like, maybe I'm a little bit slow, but collaboration is definitely a really, really important, a very big part of it. Yeah.
Especially interdisciplinary.
Yeah.
And of course, he's
different. Yeah, exactly. But so spatial ecologies, the long and short of it is, it's a week-long intensive pilot course. The last time we ran it, the way we ran it was we advertised it to current students at all levels on all courses across the university. We brought together some people, and then what we did, we sort of gave them this like crash course in what it is to design and prototype in the field, and then we took them into the field to sort of apply what they've learned, and we sort of brought all the learning and all the designing and all the recording that had happened in the field together in a collective movement performance and a collective drawing.
Whereabouts did you take them?
So we took them to a place, quite interesting place, on the north Norfolk coast. It's called it's where the sea henge was found, which is this like Bronze Age
It's like Stonehenge made out of tree trunks.
And at the very beginning of the project, we found a text by an archaeologist that frames the sea henge as a response to climate disruption in the Bronze Age. So we saw this, okay, this is interesting. This is a device that sort of, we sort of conceptualized it as a device that sort of tries in a very real way to respond to like climate disruption. And so the whole project was like, what can we learn from that as designers? Like how can we, and artists and whoever, so what can we learn from that? So it's very open-ended, and it was very kind of explorative, and and mainly you could say that in a way, thinking about ecology, thinking about environment, and thinking about climate, it didn't impact in any meaningful way, you know, sea level rises or anything like that. Mm. It didn't necessarily give us tools to sort of combat climate change in a very direct way. But what it did was, what it hopefully did was, it exposed the participants to emergent and unfamiliar practices and collaborative practices that could be a start of that conversation about what it is to move like maybe together, closer together across disciplines, and move out of studio spaces in a sense.
So it really sounds like the one of the main things that you've learned from your case studies is this power of collaboration and interdisciplinarity.
Definitely.
Yeah. And that was a new thing to the world of visual communication design. Is that more kind of centered around the idea of, you know, a single author and a single kind of creative person?
In a sense, but I think a lot of design and art is, and I think it's like this kind of modernist hangover and stuff, right? But also even, I was reading the other day, I was reading about Le Corbusier, the architect, and like the sort of what constituted the modernist ethos in like architectural design. And that author very literally talked about, it was like moving out of the field and into the laboratory, moving from like exterior to an interior. So I think it's more than that. It's kind of maybe undoing some of the side of purposeful work that has been to sort of create a distance between something that's quite situated, quite sort of to something that's more universal, objective, more sort of removed, more sort of, you know, like, you know, this idea of a privileged viewpoint and so on and so forth. It seems, and it like through my research, it appears to me that other disciplines have been quicker to undo that, including journalists, the new journalists specifically, including anthropologists, like with the big sort of, you know, they had their crisis of representation in the 80s, mid to late 80s and stuff. So we can learn a lot from them, but also looking at them can equip us with the critical apparatus that I think designers have yet to develop that will allow that kind of like looking at the studio, look at the design practice and like finding the sort of very practical applied solutions to
It reminds me, I'm thinking of Donna Haraway, and Donna Haraway is writing about situated knowledge and so forth. It's all those things coming out of feminism. I wonder if it's worth asking about, I want to talk about the case studies a little bit, but before that, let's go back to the idea of the studio in design. So a lot of disciplines kind of fetishize a studio. And they talk about studio practice, you know, with a capital S and a capital P, and it's this mysterious kind of black box thing which goes on, and it's recognized that it's crucial to creativity somehow, but a lot of times it's not very well understood and unpacked. Is that the case in your discipline, in your area? Or have you found people talking about it, or is it very much this kind of mysterious arm's length thing?
I think it's quite mysterious. I think, especially in fine art, whenever I find like really good, like, you know, critical reflection on the studio space and what it affords and stuff, it's always in the visual arts more than in design. I've found very little about, especially within visual communication design, and even design more broadly, that considers what like affordances, like what the studio affords and how it molds and shapes like design practice. Like I said before, right? Which is also something that sometimes worries me in my research, because it's almost like, it feels like sometimes that I've maybe the project should have been understanding the studio first.
Right.
It's almost like I've jumped over that and now I'm talking about leaving the studio.
Yeah.
But that there's a prerequisite there. Like, we need to understand what the studio is, right? and what it affords and what it doesn't afford.
Yeah, yeah.
In order to do that work. So, so now sort of as the sort of PhD is coming together, that's definitely something I need to sort of pay a little bit more attention to.
I have a quote. I don't know if you've come across. I don't know if you've come across this quote, but there's a book from 2017 by Susan Oren and Shreve, Art and Design Pedagogy in Higher Education. There's a great quote from there, which I've used a few times, which asks, is the studio more a state of mind than a particular physical space?
I think that's a very interesting way of framing it, because wherever you come across it, it's kind of like people have a very difficult time defining what it is. And one of the best books around it is called Studio Studies. I forget who the... I think it's Ferreras and Wilkes. Mm-hmm. Wilkes, I think he's a tutor at Goldsmiths. But I think that's kind of one of the most authoritative texts about the studio in general.
Mm.
That's beyond just the design studio. They talk it about in the broadest sense of the word. And like what they say very early on is kind of... it's just somehow a bounded space. But I think it's really interesting to talk about it in terms of being a state of mind, especially, and now I might go a little bit into one of my case studies. And that was brought back to me, or that was something that became very clear to me when I started looking at Joan Didion's Foreign Correspondence. And it's really interesting what happened in the 80s there. And sort of it was her sort of, when we think about leaving the studio, we tend to think about it in very literal terms. Like it's about going from the inside to an outside. Mm. It's going from the indoors to the wild outdoors and that kind of thing. I think that's kind of a very simplistic way of looking at it. And I think what you're saying there in terms of it being a state of mind, it's like part of that. So when I first looked at Joan Didion, I thought like, oh, she used to work in the US, right? That was her turf, like writing about the American experience around writing about American society, right? Mm-hmm. You know, slouching towards Bethlehem and all of that stuff. And now she's in Salvador. This is perfect, right? She's moving from like this kind of thing that she considers her beat.
Yeah.
To a foreign country, and she's trying to apply what she's finding there. But what I found, like looking into all the sort of, there's a great book called War Stories by Mark. It's called Pedelty. I'm gonna butcher it. It's one of the only ethnographies of war correspondence, and it's all about El Salvador.
Mm.
And he talks about. He talks about, yes, that move from the U.S. to El Salvador, and like, you know, but he says it's not as simple as that. And he uses the hotel that all the foreign correspondents used as their hub as kind of a way of talking about that. So there's this hotel in El Salvador called the Hotel Camino Real. And this is where all the sort of correspondents would work from.
Mm.
And he talks about it as kind of, it was like a first world cocoon in a third world country. And he was talking about it like the foreign correspondents would leave the United States, travel across, and then be inducted by the US embassy and like into sort of reorientated culturally by the embassy, right? And then it would end up at the hotel.
Mm.
So they left the US only to return into the US. And for me, that was really instructive in thinking about the studio. That it can, its influences can exert themselves in any context. Even when we are in the field, we might still be conditioned by the studio in our thinking and our working, right? What's interesting about Joan Didion is she was so shrewd, she was like so critical, she had such a like, you know, clear, she saw things for what they were in a sense. And she used to be a design writer herself, right? Mm. Writing for, you know, Vogue magazine and so on. And so did her husband, not for Vogue magazine, for Industrial Design magazine. And they were there as a couple, collaboration again, right? So it's really interesting to see how she met, and it's in the text itself when she realizes that she is kind of being cocooned, and she needs to do something to break that influence. Mm. That sort of this space is, in a sense, creating like this cocoon. And it's funny, like, you know, cocooning, it's then, you know, I start to look for that word, and then it comes up in other contexts and come up in, like, you know, Mark Orge, he talks about it in like that non-places thing. Mm. He talks about the hotel chain specifically, right? And
so did she manage to break out, and did what kind of impact did that have on her writing? Did it?
So she was only there for 2 weeks, and unfortunately, it was a little bit limited what I can say about that. But I can definitely, and there's different limitations to the way she worked and stuff in terms of. So I think in some senses she provides a counter narrative to what's happening there, right?
Okay.
She does that in really explicit and implicit ways in her text, El Salvador. So she's, I don't want to go too much into it, it's going to get very kind of specific, but she provides a kind of narrative. Whether her methods are truly participatory or truly collaborative is like a question, something I'm questioning in my writing.
Mm.
But I luckily find other examples of other people that are there in El Salvador at the same time as her, who has like, who are filmmakers mainly, but are doing like other really radical things.
Mm.
And so I sort of at the very end of the sort of text, I jumped from Didion to a Danish filmmaker called Jørgen Leth, who was working there and had these ideas of like collaborative fictions and stuff, and had these ideas about like sort of radical participation in his filmmaking and that kind of thing.
Mm.
So I sort of used that to sort of, Didion did all of this. He broke the cocoon. So if we think about it as the studio, right, there's like the studio, there's a threshold, and then there's like the field situation.
Mm.
So she was able to maybe cross the threshold, or at least give us the tools to cross the threshold, but maybe she didn't quite give us the methods truly participatory and like collaborative way engage with what she finds on the outside.
Let's talk about your other main case study, which is photographer Paul Hyman. And he, you're looking at his work, which ends up in a book called Reflections on Fieldwork in Morocco. Could you say a little bit about him?
So Paul Hyman, again, it's a little bit earlier, it's in the 60s. Paul Hyman is a fashion photographer. So you wouldn't necessarily think about, so you might think of, when you think of photography, you might think of documentary photography, or you might think of, you know, visual journalism or something like that. They have like very established fieldwork practices, right?
Mm.
Fashion photographers, maybe it's more studio bound in a sense. And he was a studio manager himself.
Mm. Right?
So he goes on the invitation of a very famous anthropologist and his very famous supervisor. They were not famous yet, but it's Paul Rabinow, who wrote Notes on Fieldwork in Morocco. And it's Paul Goertz, Clifford Goertz. So the famous American anthropologist that sort of did the Balinese cockfinding text and like, you know, did this, was really sort of, like an icon in like American anthropology, right? It was so funny because when I went to Morocco just to check out the field sites they were working at, you saw American anthropologists like walking around in this like really small, like, you know, satellite city of like Fez. And it was clear there was love emulating like Clifford Goertz and like walking in his footsteps. And like he still has like a really sort of a hold on like, you know, the social sciences in the States.
I didn't know you'd been out there to check this out. What was your purpose of going to Morocco?
I did it just after COVID, and it was. And I think that speaks again to me being a practitioner first, and then like, you know, becoming more and more, I guess, a theorist or academic, or what you call it. But I found it really difficult to engage with all of these ideas in the abstract, like these ideas of like, you know, the studio and what it is, and sociology and like anthropology and like all. It was just like, it was very remote in a way, right? Mm. Like it's tangible, like concrete. You know, like Didion talks about, she talks about how she doesn't have access to the world of ideas. She always focuses on the concrete, the tangible, over the abstract, right? And I feel as practitioners, we feel like that a lot of the time. Mm. I felt I had to go those places. So it was mainly with the purpose of going there and retracing as well, but more in my case, maybe more Paul Rabinow's footsteps. Mm. So I went to Marrakesh and I went by train up to Fez. I sort of hired a cab for the day. Mm-hmm. And went out to Sifrou, which is this like little oasis town where he did all his field work, where he did his doctoral thesis, and where Paul Hyman joined him, the photographer joined him. Mm. And then I went to Tangier and took the ferry to, and then I just traveled overland all the way back, right? So I was flying there. I traveled overland back to the UK. You know, I tried to be sustainable in my own research as well. Right? But
Will that trip work its way into your thesis somehow?
It will, because it gave me a really acute understanding of what kind of place it was and what kind of place it is now. Hmm. And I think that's also quite important when you're working with historical material. You need to understand if it still has application today, if circumstances have changed too much, and so on and so forth. But for me, it was just like being in the place, understanding the place, getting a sense of these kind of different milieus that I'd only experienced in writing. And then I did a lot of situated reading, right? I took my reflection of fieldworks in Morocco with me and sat on by the Blue Gate and
How was that? Was that different to reading that at home?
It was, and it was funny because it became almost like my travel guide. Hmm. Because his insight into Moroccan culture and like the ways Moroccans are in the world and that kind of thing was very instructive in my interactions with Moroccans then. Hmm. And a lot of it still held true, which is kind of... So it gave me like really concrete tools to sort of navigate that space. In a way. But so that's a little bit apart from the research, I guess.
Hyman ended up producing a photo essay within this book, which is a set of really amazing photographs of the people of Morocco.
Yes, yes and no. So, and I think that's really interesting because in American social science, Paul Rabinow is like the rogue. He's like the innovator. He's the trailblazer in terms of like experimental practice, in terms of breaking, disciplinary boundaries. So he started out as like a anthropologist. He went to become a Foucault scholar. And then he went on to become like a biochemist, working in biochemistry.
An unusual trajectory.
Yeah, exactly. He's really sort of always, and this is something that's, I found out in conversation with my supervision team here. But Clifford Geertz is very much seen as this kind of social scientist in a sense, that he's kind of, but it's, he's more comfortable being bounded by his discipline in a sense. Mm. And he's really interested in exploring that discipline and what it can do and like innovating it as well, right? But if you look at those two books, so there was two books that feature, there's more than two, but there's two main works that I'm looking at that feature Hyman's photography. One of them is Paul Rabinow's fieldworks in Morocco. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it as a design object, it's very conventional in a sense. It has text and then occasionally it has an image. So there's something there about, and I go into that in the research. I'm not going to talk too much about that now, but about like the sort of, the hierarchy between the textual and the visual, which I'm very interested in as a visual communication designer, that the text always very often dictates the image, right? The caption is where the meaning making happens.
Yeah.
It's not in the image itself.
Yeah, so the text anchors the meaning.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And sort of Yeah. And so in a way, like the treatment that Hyman's photography gets in Rabinow's book is a very conventional one. Mm. So if you look at the other book that came out a few years later, which was this tome, this like very, very big book published by Clifford Geertz, his wife, and another American anthropologist called Lawrence Rose, it has the photo essay in it. But there, the images, so the way Clifford Geertz talks about it, he talks about it like it's self-structured and it's kind of... It's almost like produces knowledge in its own terms. There's no captions alongside the images. There's a short essay at the end, or there's a short image, illustration list at the end of that essay. But also within the book itself is a very conventional piece of like an anthropological monograph, right? It's like solid pages of text, right? Mm. All through it, like the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages. And then right at the middle, you have this kind of photo essay that sort of almost, it's like lodged in the book like a foreign object, right? Mm. And if you look at the page numbers, the page number stops on one side of the photo essay and picks up on the other, right? So it's clear, like there's a very sort of, it's almost like it's a really great metaphor of like how the social sciences at the time had a very difficult time holding the image and understanding what its role was, which is much better now, right? Mm. The other really interesting about it is the way it's laid out. It's laid out with like big splash images, smaller image, big splash image, like double page splash image, mm-hmm. right? And the sign of it was done not by Hyman himself and not by the anthropologists or like, you know, the editors at Cambridge University Press. It was done by a Brazilian-born American art director that had worked for Harper's Bazaar. So the photo is laid out like Harper's Bazaar.
There's lots of full bleed images.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, full bleed images, yeah. That kind of thing, right? So, So the way it becomes like this self-structured visual narrative mm. is also through collaboration. Mm. It's a collaboration between Hyman and B.F. Feidler, mm. the American art director. And it becomes this like... and for me, that photo essay is a really good exemplar of what you want design to be. Like that you want... or what design... what could be a model for taking design practice into the field. That is highly mobile, it's highly collaborative, but also it sort of does things on its own terms in a way.
What would you say you've taken from these case studies? Like what have you taken from them, and how does that then move into you're planning another iteration of spatial ecologies very soon? What are you going to try and bring from those into this next iteration, do you think?
So we want to, so we have like there's certain limitations, like either financial or institutional in terms of like, I don't know, like my dream would be if we like camped out like in a space that was outside of an institutional or studio-based context, right? But, you know, there's some practicalities there that means that we sort of very often have to bring it back into sort of more conventional studio spaces, right? So my dream would be that it's more like in the field in a sense. It's very early days. And we are still like, and again, it's a collaborative effort. I'm talking to Gustavo, I'm talking to Elin, we are talking to Teresa about what the next iteration looks like.
It's great to hear about all the things that you've been doing. And I know we haven't really talked about this, but you've also done quite a lot of archival research in relation to these as well. And I imagine that puts you again in kind of direct contact with the past, doesn't it? In the way that visiting particular sites might. I wondered, in a more general kind of reflection, though, what would you say that, this is, again, the big question in some ways, what would you say that the practical side, the practice element of your research has brought to your project?
I think this idea, like, you know, having these historical case studies, if that was the end of the project, as a designer, I would feel very dissatisfied, because for me it would stay too much in the realm of theory. Mm. And I think the spatial ecologies course, doing the we also did one in collaboration. I did one in collaboration with an architect and good friend of mine, Emil Seehusen, which was more international in a way. Giving these opportunities to field test ideas in collaboration with other creative practitioners, regardless of what discipline they come out of, is kind of, for me as a designer, immensely rewarding, right? And it helps me get to grips with the ideas in a very hands-on way. And I also, it's almost like the premise, as I said at the beginning, it's the whole premise of the project that, Turo Escobar says, designers just need to align themselves more with the concerns of like anthropology, and like go into like the social theory space and that kind of thing. Isn't that like in a way like throwing out everything that is kind of not about ideas and about like making and about creative practice and like, yeah. And well, where's the place for that then, right? So I think it's, when I start, it's a long time ago now, but when I started my PhD, like the first thing I did was I read the Umberto Eco book, on writing a thesis. And it's kind of, in many ways, it's very quaint, because when he talks about like how he keeps notes, it's like, you know, and little paper slips, and like he talks in a very meticulous way about how he sort of notes down on these small, like on this little filing system and that kind of thing. In some ways, it's really quaint and a little bit anachronistic. But some of the things he says in that book as well is like, you need to do the PhD the thesis that you can do. You shouldn't try to turn your back on everything you were before. You need to do something that sort of aligns in a natural way and extends. Now I'm paraphrasing here, right? That's definitely not what he says in the book. But you need to sort of extend on like what constitutes your way of working in a way. Mm. And I think very much as designers, it's kind of, at least historically, if you wanted to go into academia, if you wanted to do a PhD, you've very often and maybe too often been taken out of that making space and into like maybe a purely theoretical space. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that is a great place to stop. So thank you so much for coming in and talking today. It's been really fascinating, really interesting. Great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's been a pleasure getting to speak to you about my research.
Husk.